I'm not interested in facts. I'm interested in truth, but a truth, as Herzog says, of ecstasy, an ecstatic truth. Not a verbal truth, not a rational truth, not a historical truth either, but a truth of ecstasy.
Herzlich willkommen zu Hansa Rauschen, dem Literaturpodcast des Hansa Verlages. Mein Name ist Florian Kessler. Hier sprechen alle zwei Wochen Lektorinnen und Lektoren mit Menschen aus der Welt der Bücher, mit Schreibenden und Lesenden, mit Leuten von anderen Verlagen und aus dem Haus. Es geht um alles, was in Bücher passt und außenrum passiert. Und das ist wirklich nicht wenig. Willkommen zur neuen Folge von Hansa Rauschen, bei der wir den Globus so richtig rotieren lassen. Zu Gast haben wir den äußerst ungewöhnlichen, zwischen Guatemala und den USA pendelnden Schriftsteller Eduardo Halfon, der längst in der Flüsterpost in einem Atemzug mit den ganz großen lateinamerikanischen Schriftstellern wie Roberto Bolaño genannt wird. Halfons schmale, wie komprimiert wirkende Romane erzählen wie im Spiegelkabinett immer weiter von anderen, vielleicht nur halbfiktiven Eduardo Halfons, leuchten seine Familiengeschichte und die Geschichte des Exils seiner weit verzweigten Familie aus, bleiben dabei bei weitem nicht stehen. Bei Hansa sind bereits drei letztlich kaum zu trennende Romane von ihm erschienen, zuletzt im vergangenen Herbst Duell, übersetzt jedes Mal von Louis Ruby. Über seine erste deutsche Veröffentlichung, damals übersetzt gemeinsam mit Peter Kulzen, schrieb der Literaturkritiker Andreas Breitenstein 2014 in der Neuen Zürcher Zeitung. Seiner jüdischen Herkunft entlaufen und doch dem Schatten der Geschichte nie entkommen, ist Eduardo Halfon ein Bewohner des Niemandslands zwischen Erfindung und Erinnerung. Sein Roman macht uns wahr, indem er uns frei macht. Man muss nur voll seiner autobiografischen Trickserei vertrauen können. Dieser Trickserei hat sich hier für den Podcast im Gespräch auf Englisch mit Eduardo Halfon, dessen Lektor Piero Salabé, angenommen. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
So, I'm very happy to be here today with Eduardo Halfon, who is one of the finest Latin American authors, which we publish in our publishing company, and his latest book we have published is called Duel, Duel in English, but it has different titles in different editions. We will talk about this, but first of all, welcome to Germany, Eduardo.
Thank you, Piero. It is always a pleasure to be here.
I know it's very cold and you have a cold, but all the same, you are ready to have an interview and a podcast, so we're very happy.
Thank you. I used to live in Nebraska and Iowa, so this is not that
That's
cold.
That's not so terrible
for This
you,
is not so okay. terrible. And I always have a cold because I have allergies.
It's normal to speak this way.
This so is normal.
It's very good to know. And we are grateful that you have time to spend with us. I just said that you are one of the finest Latin American authors, and I'm just wondering, how come that you speak English like a native? You're from Guatemala?
I am. I was born in Guatemala in 1971, but left in 1981. So the day after my 10th birthday, it was August of 81, we fled, basically.
Oh, yes. Why?
The political situation, the internal conflict, the armed internal conflict, the civil war, had been going on for 20 years, but it entered the city in the late 70s, 1980. And in 81, it really escalated. I remember very little, Piero, about all this. I was very young. We were overprotected. But I do remember, for example, falling asleep to gunfire and thinking that was normal. I remember a bodyguard suddenly showing up at the house and sleeping by the door all night. I have these memories of things changing.
So you fled to the U.S. Where to?
Yeah, we fled to Florida with the understanding, or this is at least what they told us, children, that it was temporary.
I see.
Just while things calmed down. And that wound up being 12 years. We stayed. I finished school in Florida, and then I studied engineering in North Carolina, and English became my stronger language. It is still my stronger language. I would rather read in English. I would rather write in English. Yeah. I would rather speak in English. Yeah. But I am forced, for some reason, to read, write, and speak in Spanish. And I only write in Spanish.
Well, this you will tell us later when we have talked a little bit about your new book. So your own story is a story of someone who flies from his country into another. But your ancestors, your grandparents, were themselves refugees, were they?
They were refugees, they were migrants, nomads. Which
Where did they come from?
Europe, but very different places. So my paternal grandfather, Halfon, is from Beirut.
From Lebanon.
Well, Lebanon didn't exist until a few years after he left, but he always called himself Lebanese. Yes. I think it's more of an identity than a nationality. But he left Beirut with his family in 1917.
I see.
So right around the Great Famine of Lebanon. His wife, my grandmother, was from Alexandria.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
They met in Guatemala.
They met in Guatemala.
Yeah, yeah. My other grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was Polish.
Polish, I see.
From Lodz.
From what?
Or Wódz.
Yes.
How do you say it in German?
Lodz.
Lodz. And my grandmother, his wife, was from Aleppo.
Aleppo, from Syria.
From Syria, and they also met in Guatemala. So 3/4 of my grandparents, 3 out of the 4 of them, were Arabic. Very spoke Arabic, lived Arabic, ate very Arabic, and one Polish.
Very interesting. The thing is, we are mentioning this because in your work, the family history has a particular relevance.
Right.
We have published already 2 books of yours. One is called The Polish Boxer. The other one is called Signor Hoffman.
Yep.
And now we are publishing here Duell.
Duell.
Yeah? Der Polnische Boxer is the German title of that first book.
Right.
And your books are part of a work where the story, in which the story of the family plays a very, very strong role, in fact, because all of these stories have somehow related with stories from your own family, which is also the story of a Jewish family.
Right.
Yes?
Right.
How come that you have decided to concentrate on your family? Is this going to be something which is your aim, to have this family story divided into books and books and books?
You use 2 words that I found very interesting. One is decided, and the other is aim. I don't remember.
Neither nor.
Neither nor. Well, you know why? Because I never thought it out. I just began writing this way. And I'm still within that genre, so to speak. I began this way 17 years ago. With stories very close to my family, very close to me, and I'll explain a little bit about that. And I'm still there, Piero. I'm still working on these stories. I feel as if I use my family's history, yes, whether it be the Lebanese or the Polish or even the Guatemala of the 1970s, almost as a backdrop to write stories, to write fiction. So to give you a theater analogy, if this was theater, my biography, my life, my persona, my narrator has my name. Yeah,
Eduardo
Halfon. And he looks a lot like me. He smokes.
That's the difference.
That's one of the differences. There's others.
You don't smoke.
I don't smoke.
You don't smoke yet, but maybe if I offer you a cigarette,
I can't.
In order to divide these two,
I have to respect the two of Eduardos. So all of this is backdrop. All of this is just the scene I set up on stage. So it's the props. It's the backdrop, and then the drama that takes place in front of that backdrop is the fiction. So the story that I'm going to tell in Duell, or the story that I tell in any one of my short stories, whether it be O Ghetto, My Love, or Signor Hoffman, or The Polish Boxer, is fiction. It is theater.
It is.
Yeah? So I don't want to tell you my grandfather's story. I want to use my grandfather's story as almost a pretext to tell you something else.
I understand this. All the same, in your books, especially we were talking about The Polnische Boxer, you write about, for instance, you write the story of your maternal grandfather,
right,
who spent some time as a prisoner.
A lot of time. Yeah, whole war.
In Sachsenhausen.
Yeah.
And you investigated the thing, you made a trip. So all this information you deliver in the books about your trips to understand the story of this man, of your family, of your family, is real. These things happened.
Right.
You went to Germany, you went to Sachsenhausen, you went to Rutsch Lodge to, you know, understand his own biography, or is this false?
Not necessarily.
No. But did it happen or not?
That's a tricky question. And I think I'm going to quote Werner Herzog, who's also one of your authors, is he not?
He publishes with Hansa. He lived here in Munich.
Let us not confuse what's real with what's true.
Mm.
Yeah. I use certain elements of my life, quote unquote, of this reality that you consider my life, to lull you into thinking that I'm writing autobiography. And I believe in that hypnosis, in that state of belief, of absolute belief. There is no disbelief there in my readers. They think that my grandfather was in Auschwitz. They believe it. They believe that my other grandfather left Beirut, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So any story that I insert within that belief is much stronger. It's felt much deeper. Yeah, so the emotional response I'm after will be greater. Yeah,
than the real story.
Than the real, what's real, what's not real, what's fiction, what's fact. I'm not interested in facts. I'm interested in truth, but a truth, as Herzog says, of ecstasy, an ecstatic truth, not a verbal truth, not a rational truth, not a historical truth either. But a truth of ecstasy, of something I feel and I want you to feel. It's almost like a coming together of reader and writer in an emotion.
In an emotion.
So I will use any trick at my disposal.
Yeah.
And one of those tricks is giving my narrator my name. That's just a trick.
All the same, this subject in your books about the genocide, about you know, the relationship with that in your own family, is very often just a starting point of a consideration about human destiny, grief. And
absolutely,
so,
or identity.
I have a very concrete question, because in your books, you write about your trips to Germany, you write about, in fact, also in Duell, about having discovered in Frankfurt the Stolpersteine.
Right.
Now you're again in Germany. How do you feel? What is your emotion being in this country, which has this tragic story also related with your own family?
Funny, I was thinking about that on the train as I was coming today from Paris.
Yes.
And when I got into Germany, there's two things that I thought of almost spontaneously. One is the denseness. There's almost this dense quality of a Jew being in Germany. No? Even so far removed from what happened here, I can't help look at the countryside, that, you know, from the train, and think of that. Think of what happened there in that mountain 70 years ago. It's inevitable for me. But at the same time, my demeanor, my character is extremely organized and methodical and engineer-like. And so I feel very much at home in Germany, because things work. They don't work in Paris.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I know. I'm exaggerating, maybe, but I'm coming from a very disorganized world in Latin America.
Yes.
So I felt both of those things, but part of my history is here.
Is here.
Whether I like it or not, it's not by choice.
So let us talk now about the story, the particular story you narrate in Duell.
Right.
You start saying that there is an uncle of yours,
right,
whose name is Salomon, who apparently as a child you thought he was drowned in a lake in Guatemala called Amatitlan.
Yeah.
And later on you discover that this might not be true.
Right.
And in this book you write your search. Somehow you go back to the place in Guatemala in order to find out the truth. Is it right? Is it not right?
I discovered another truth.
You discovered another truth, but right. You still didn't know exactly which right. version could be true. But the first question I have on the story, which is, you know, the core of your book, why did you go to Guatemala? Why were you interested in that story?
Well, I always go to Guatemala. My parents live there. We have a small apartment there with my wife and son. So we go all the time. But this happened, Piero, in 2015. In the summer of 2015, I was back. And perhaps the best way to answer your question is to tell you where this story came from. We were visiting in August of 2015, and I was having a glass of wine with my father. Do you remember the scene? It was part of Duel, and then we took it out at the very end. We took it out. And we were having a glass of wine, and I was asking about his older brother, Salomon, or he who would have been his older brother, but who died as a kid. And I kept asking him questions about his death and about the lake and about what really happened to Salomon, which is that he did not die in the lake. As I thought as a kid. And my father told me a little bit. He didn't know too much. He would come in and out and say a little and then not say too much. And at the very end of that conversation, he said, "But please don't write anything about this." And the first thing I did when I got home was write the first page of what wound up being Duel. Something is triggered in me by censorship or by somebody trying to tell me what not to write about. It makes me that much more interested. I didn't yet know what I was writing. I didn't know where I was going with that story. I just wrote the first page and I found it very interesting. The tone of it.
You were haunted.
I was haunted. Exactly. That's the right word. Yeah. There's something haunting in that first page.
In that first page.
So I just kept going.
Yeah,
I kept going, and so then the novel, which is a very very short novel, suddenly splits into several times. You know? So a search in childhood, growing up in the Guatemala of the 1970s, not thinking that this boy had died at the lake, which is a lake where we would go every weekend. So I was afraid of the water. I thought I was gonna, you know, find his body because I had never found his body. And then growing up in Florida during my teens, where I slowly start to find out the truth of what really happened to him. And the third moment of in time is present, where my narrator goes back to the lake.
Goes back to the lake.
To search for something. Exactly. We don't know what he's searching for yet, but he's searching for something.
But you just said that when you were older, an older child.
Yeah.
You discovered the truth.
Right.
So why shall he go back to the lake if he knows the truth?
I think what he wants to find out at the lake, I think, is why was he told that Salomon had died in a drowning?
Yeah.
So the truth that he really wants is why was my memory mistaken? Where did this false memory come from? Who told me that Salomon had died in the lake and why? That's what he's after. He's not after what happened to Salomon. He knows what happened to Salomon. He died in New York, right? And the story of his death, Piero, as you know, is much worse than drowning in a lake.
Exactly, exactly.
It's much worse. That's why it was a family secret. That's why nobody spoke of him. Nobody uttered his name.
Yeah.
To this day, I have young cousins who don't even know he existed because when he died, his name died.
I remember one part of the book. It's at the end, more or less, where we have an argument, a confrontation between the two brothers, the brother of the narrator and the narrator, And the narrator, you know, breaks the foot of his brother. Is this correct?
Yeah.
Yes. And then he has a strong conversation with his father.
Right.
And in the moment where he expects the father to, you know, hit him or just to be very angry at him, the picture reappears, the picture, you know, with a boy in the snow, 1940 in New York. So this is the evidence that his brother, the brother of your father, your uncle, hadn't died drowned in the lake.
Right.
All the same, you seem, as the narrator seems to, you know, forget this aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a connection between, let's say, psychologically, the feeling of guilt and this obliteration, this forgetting?
I think so. I think so. I hadn't even thought of it that way. So it's not something that was preconceived in my part. But there is an absolute link between the guilt of the narrator about the way he treated his younger brother and the guilt of a family on the way this family treated this young boy and left him to die by himself in New York. And then with the memory of this young boy that was also almost buried with him. No, we will bury your name. We will bury the even the memory of you. But then there's also the guilt of a country.
Oh yes, no? Which is Guatemala.
Guatemala. Yes. No? And almost the lake itself almost becomes a metaphor for the country. And there's this dying lake. It's a dying lake. The lake that in the 1970s was beautiful and pristine and blue is now on the verge of dying. It is so contaminated. So the lake also, there's a guilt, there's a national guilt, not only towards the countryside,
yes,
but towards the indigenous, towards the consequences of decades of mistreatment. So there is, guilt is a very strong word in the book. And I think it explains, but we won't say much about this, or maybe we can, the last page of the book. There's a last scene in the book where the narrator walks into the water.
Mm.
And it's not really clear why. I don't know if I know exactly why. But I knew that when I wrote it, that was the ending of the book. And I think it has a lot to do with guilt.
In the last page, you associate two words. I think one is ecstasy and the other is grief.
Yes.
So how do you arrive to this act of self-punishment somehow or letting disappear yourself as a narrator? Combining these two other aspects.
But you see,
aspects.
One way to read that ending is as a self-punishment or a disappearing into the lake. But there's another way, Piero, which is of rebirth, almost of a baptism.
Oh, yes.
Of walking into water.
So this is, of course...
It's another possible reading. I think both readings are absolutely valid. And if you read the guilt in the story and then read that last page, it almost reads more as a baptism. And I think the key word there is ecstasy. I think the word
ecstatic,
ecstatic. There's a euphoria in the narrator. I think there's at least two ways of responding to that. One is giving Salomon back his name.
Mm-hmm.
Right, he gets his name back. That name that he had lost, and in the first page of the book, we take away. He gets it back. And the second way to interpret that is that the guilt that the narrator feels is not towards Salomon, it's not towards the country, it's not towards the family, it's towards his brother. It's the breaking the foot of my brother. It's the mistreatment of my brother. It's really a book about brothers.
Yes, exactly.
My grandfather and his brother, my father and his brother.
Could we just dwell a little bit about
the title?
The title, yeah. Because in German it's Duell,
Duell,
which is a confrontation.
Right.
In English, you chose the title Mourning.
Well, the publisher did.
Yeah, the publisher did, which means Trauer, yes? Trauer. In Germany, you would say Trauer. So the Spanish words had several meanings. Can you explain them? And what is the Spanish word?
The Spanish word is duelo, which has at least three meanings, or let's say three meanings. Duelo in Spanish means duel in English, so confrontation. Mm-hmm. It means duelo como luto, so mourning with a U, mourning. What was the German word for mourning?
Trauer.
Trauer. And it means pain.
Schmerz, yes.
Dolor, yo duelo. Mm-hmm. It's a personal pain, right? And all three of those words are very present in the book. So the title in Spanish is absolutely perfect because it condenses three main themes of the book into one solitary word. This is very rare. We have not been able to do that in any translation of the book. So the English, the publisher, Erica, chose mourning, and we agreed. But she had to decide. She had to go with either duel, as in combat in English, or mourning. She couldn't do both. The French title, do you remember the French title? Deuil, with an S.
Yeah.
So the plural version of deuil in French. And in German, I remember when we discussed this in Zagreb, we decided on Duell, which I love.
We were criticized in the press.
We were. I read that. I don't agree with them because it is one of the, I would even say that it's an even stronger theme in the book, the duel between brothers. Yeah, this is a very Cain and Abel book. It is a book about confrontation between two brothers.
Not only the brothers in the generation of the narrator, but also in the generation of
the grandfather and of the father.
And of the father himself.
The relationship of my father with the brother he never knew.
So I have now a very concrete, maybe even banal question. The protagonist drinks a potion.
Right.
In that final scene where he has this ecstatic moment and goes into the lake.
Right.
What is that potion made of?
Oh, I don't know. We would have to go ask Doña Ermelinda.
Okay. But this character, this old lady who's able, you know, to tell all the victims
of drowning
that lake during decades, who are by the end the victims possibly of a terrible, you know, unhuman system, which is, you know, also the country you fled from. The stories she tells about the several boys, how many boys die there? Do you know?
Oh, it just happened again a few weeks
ago.
Okay. It happens all the time, and I'll tell you what's tragic about this. Mm-hmm. It happens way too often, and it's usually very poor boys from the neighboring villages.
I see.
So these are people who don't know how to swim.
Oh, I see.
So you live by a lake, but you don't know how to swim.
This would be rather the consequence of, you know, maybe ignorance, low education, not really the violence aspect.
No. Exactly. It's a different type of violence when you allow children to die that way. Mm. You know, because this is extreme poverty. So extreme that you live by a lake but never learn how to swim. Nobody ever teaches you how to swim. So it's a country who turns its back on its children. So, which I think that's the haunting part.
One of the, I think, very interesting aspects of your book, your novel, is the way you link the personal history with the history of a country.
Right.
And we are here in Germany, and of course it has been a ritual to understand how much, you know, the German population was responsible for what happened during the Second World War. Family can also have moments of redemption.
I think so.
A family, rather than a country, a country. Germany tried.
Yes.
Germany tried very hard.
Yes. I think so. But I think it's a process that takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. It's a hard process when it's one person. Imagine when it's a group, whether that group be a family or a community or a country. It's a very, very hard process towards redemption or towards even acknowledging that guilt. Just to acknowledge that guilt. I'll give you another example. This is something that the U.S. has, and I lived there for half my life, so I know this, has never done with slavery. The great guilt of America is slavery. If you travel through the South, there's still monuments everywhere that glorify slavery. It would be like traveling through Germany and seeing monuments of Goebbels and the likes. That would never happen in Germany. In the U.S., they still will not even acknowledge that guilt and that problem. So for that country, for a country to find its way towards redemption is a huge undertaking.
There is, in modern psychology, one direction called systemic constellations or systemic family constellation, where the individual is asked not only to talk about, let's say, his relationship with his, partner, maybe parents, but he has to reconstruct the story of his own ancestors. The interesting thing is that idea of being connected to the destiny of your ancestors apparently has this healing effect, because you then discover that someone in your family was forgotten, not acknowledged, and so on. And so he goes back to that levels in order to say, you're not only the child of your parents, but the chain is much longer.
Yeah.
So do you believe in this?
Absolutely.
So a therapeutical...
Yeah. And I'll give you two other ways of explaining the same phenomenon. One is just a family karma. No, almost as if your traumas, you inherit your traumas as well from your grandfathers and your great-grandfathers. And it's almost passed down through DNA. It's almost an inheritance, not only of your strong characteristics, but of the traumas that need to be healed as well. There's this thing that we're carrying, and I as a Guatemalan Jewish, Lebanese, Syrian, there's all these things that I am that you can't see if you see me, but that I'm carrying with me. A dead uncle, a grandfather who was imprisoned for 6 years, a grandfather who had to flee hunger in Beirut. All of that past hasn't passed, as Faulkner said. It stays with us. Yeah. And so the healing process of any human being, or just the understanding process, is not just about me. It is about my family and my community.
And this can also, can also be said about bigger communities, about whole countries.
Absolutely.
And that's what Germany tried after the war to be responsible and remember what happened.
Right.
But as we see also nowadays, it seems to be very difficult to cope with that grief.
So. Yeah.
And there is also always the temptation of forgetting.
Because it's not, not permanent, There's always the risk of going back to those nefarious times.
Let me ask you one last question about the Lake Amatitlan. There is a character in the book, and he's, I think, a gardener, Isidoro. And he is asked by the narrator and his narrator's brother, what the name of the lake means.
Right.
And he gives several answers. Sibylline answers.
Yeah.
Which are these answers? Do you remember them?
I remember some. I remember his last one especially.
Yes, tell me.
But he says various, it means the place of the Amate tree, mm-hmm. which Amatitlan is surrounded or was surrounded. There aren't many more of these trees. They're beautiful, huge. They almost look like baobabs.
Mm.
Yeah, they're called amates. Yeah. So one possible answer is Amatitlan, mm-hmm. comes from the tree.
Yeah.
But it also means in ancient Maya, the place of scribes,
mm-hmm.
where people write down.
Interesting. I suppose these are all explanation,
yes.
But why did you put that into the book? You wanted the lake to be a place that has somehow many names, not just one name.
Right, the many names of the drowned boys. I think it's leading up to that as well.
Yeah.
But also, there's theories on the names. So there isn't a truth there. Yeah? Don Isidoro gives several answers for the meaning of the lake. There isn't one answer. There isn't one solution. It's not a mathematical problem. And I think this is a constant in my work, as you've seen. The doubt of the narrator, the doubt of the story itself, and the doubt of memory.
Eduardo, thank you so much for this really interesting conversation. We look forward to your next work and wish you all the best.
Thank you, Piero. Likewise.
Das war es für heute mit dem Podcast Hansa Rauschen. Das waren viele Worte für viele interessante Dinge. Bis zur nächsten Folge und danke fürs Zuhören.